Hi, folks, and thanks for listening to this podcast. A couple of quick things before we kick off. Just, I didn't mention it on the pod, but at the end, the song is by Martin Leahy. He's an Irish singer-songwriter, an activist singer-songwriter, and it's his song, You Can't Bury Palestine. So shout out to Martin, and thanks for the use of his song. Also, we need your support. Tortoise Shack is the home of the podcast. It's also the home of Echo Chamber, Reboot Republic, Police, Musical, The Fresh Batch, which I love, and lots of other podcasts. And they're all available in one consolidated feed, completely plea-free, at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It is the easiest bit of activism you can do on a monthly basis. So please, while you're listening to the pod, click the link, have a look around, and join us. Come on board, try it for a month. You'll become part of the Tortoise Shack community that we're developing while helping us carve out the bit of space we need to continue to have conversations like the one you're about to listen to. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I am shutting up now. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Palcast, a podcast brought to you by Yusuf Jamal here in Istanbul, Helena Coban in Washington, D.C., and Tony Groves in Dublin. Helena is the SEO of Just Word Educational, and Tony, our great producer, works for the Tortoise Shack podcast. Today it's April 16 and it's 4 p.m. here in Istanbul. I come from a Nusayrat refugee camp in Gaza, and the refugee camp and my family, my friends, have been subjected to an intense Israeli campaign of shelling, bombing. My family is sending me videos, recordings of non-stop Israeli shooting, shelling, and bombing. And they're destroying a building after another, a neighborhood after another. They've been targeting what we call the new camp, Al-Mukhayyam Al-Jadid, in Nusayrat, which is located to the north of the refugee camp. And it's very close to Al-Mughraqa and Al-Zahra towns. These two towns were also leveled to the ground. We will talk about this and more with our guest, Huda Amouri, who is a Palestinian, Iraqi, British activist. Huda is the co-founder of the Direct Action Group, Palestine Action. She has a wealth of campaigning, research, and writing experience targeting British complicity with the colonization of Palestine. Very good to have you, Huda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, what's happening in Gaza is unbelievable, unprecedented on many different levels. The amount of killing, but also bragging about, killing, is something that we've never seen. For the past 75 years as Palestinians. And as Palestinians, whether from Gaza, the West Bank, or, East Jerusalem, historic Palestine, the diaspora, we do care about what's happening in Palestine. And I think Palestinians in the diaspora play an important role in this, campaigning and raising awareness. I would like to hear from you about the work you are involved in, but also your family's history. How did you end up in the UK? Because, we have to contextualize the story of every single Palestinian, those who live in the diaspora, how they ended up in the diaspora. Please tell us your story.
Yeah, so my dad was expelled from Palestine in 1967, and he was with his younger brothers and sisters at the time when the Israeli military were shooting into their home. And basically, they had to hide under the table in their front room and crawl out of the back of their house in order to escape. And, they were in caves for several days without humanitarian aid. And actually, my grandma was breastfeeding at the time. So she was struggling to do that because of the lack of, food and access to that. Eventually, they made their way to Kuwait, and then they ended up being Palestinian refugees in Iraq. And, you know, my mum's family, my mother is from Iraq, from Basra originally, but they live in Baghdad. And they met at university because, you know, back then when they were going to university, it was free in Iraq. So it was accessible to people, you know, who didn't have much access to resources. And eventually they came over to England and they couldn't go back. They always wanted to go back to Iraq, but obviously there were so many wars and invasions and occupations that, you know, we ended up growing up here, me and my brothers. And from both sides of the family, we were the only ones who came to a Western country. Most of my father's family now live in Jordan and elsewhere. And my mother's family are all in Iraq. But, you know, as you will know and understand, that Palestinians, once they are displaced from Palestine, they end up, you know, not to the same degree as what's happening now in Gaza, but they end up moving from place to place to place. Because the nowhere is really home for them. And so I think that was the case for my family and for my extended family. So the work I'm involved in now, I co-founded a Direct Action Network. And this was after many years of doing different types of campaigning. So I was doing a lot of divestment campaigning. So campaigning for universities and public pension funds to divest from companies who were complicit in the occupation. I also, you know, did campaigns against HSBC and lobbied MPs. I was actually working for Palestine Solidarity Campaign for 2 years before Palestine Action was formed. And I left because I realized the limitations of constantly appealing to the oppressors, appealing to the same institutions to change their material complicity, and realizing that I was going to get the same response time and time again. And that really it was, and when you get to that point, you realize that, okay, maybe I need to start to do it. We need to start doing direct action. So myself and many other people got involved in taking direct action against Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons firm. And we would go inside their London headquarters, spray paint inside. We would occupy the weapons factories, go on the roofs and shut them down and do this again and again. And that started 4 years ago. And now we've had hundreds of people taking these types of actions against Israeli weapons factories that are in England.
That's amazing. Could you please share with us the successes you made in this campaign with other people involved in the campaign, of course, but also the role of Elbit Systems? I think some people do not know more about the role of Elbit Systems, especially in the siege of Gaza, providing the Israeli military with, you know, software to besiege Palestinians in Gaza, building the wall in the West Bank. But specifically now in the genocide in Gaza, using these, you know, drones, quadcopters, and shooting and killing Palestinians. Please tell us more about this.
Yeah, so Elbit Systems is the biggest Israeli weapons manufacturer, and they are vital to arming the ongoing genocide in Gaza right now as we speak. And the thing about how the Israeli weapons trade works, which is quite unique to other weapons companies, is that they have been using Gaza as a laboratory for their weaponry for you know, for a very long time. And this gives them an advantage. And they will openly say this, that they will first use attacks on Gaza as a way of developing new weaponry. So then they can sell it to other countries and say, look, we've tested it. We've shown you how it works. And sometimes these weapons are in very early development stages. They're not even finished weaponry. But they use these attacks as an opportunity to do this. And this is what is going on right now. We know that the drones that are being used are made by Elbit Systems. Israel in general describes himself as a pioneer of drones. And this is largely to do with Gaza, because when the troops withdrew and they began the siege, their way of maintaining the occupation surveillance and harassment of the Palestinians was largely through these drones flying in the air 24/7 a day. And we know what these drones can do in terms of massacring Palestinians, and that's what they're being used for right now. On top of that, they also started using Iron Sting missiles, which are also new. And these are chemical missiles which burn through the flesh of Palestinians. They're not like white phosphorus, but they're not like normal missiles. And this, again, is completely experimental. As you mentioned, the quadcopters that are being used, again, made by Elbit Systems. We've seen how they use that to besiege the hospitals. And just to give some context on the drones as well, in 2021, during the bombing of Gaza, they would use artificial intelligence drones for the first time. And the Israeli general actually would say about how Elbit were not just arming them, they were in the room with them conducting these attacks on the Palestinian people. So they work with the Israeli military. So they're a key part of the whole apparatus of the Zionist military. And recently, there was an annual investor conference by Elbit, and the CEO was talking about how they have ramped up production. And, you know, they have a shortage right now, the Zionists, of munitions and missiles and bombs because of how much they are using on Gaza, and that they are working day and night to replenish this stock. But they also would say things like that they feel like civil soldiers, the Elbit workers, for their contribution to the genocide that is happening right now. And that now they called 2021 the first AI war, and now they're calling this the first digital war. And the reason is because Elbit's new system is a digital system which connects all of this different weaponry. So the drones, the missiles, the planes, the tanks, to one system to connect it all together to make it easier for them to commit and more efficient for them to commit this genocide. And again, this is all experimental stuff that is happening. And we can see them openly talking about how this is going to be used as an opportunity. They have also had problems. Elbit have had problems because of this. And they've said because 15% of their staff have gone to work for the IDF, have gone back into the army, which has meant that they are now, the rest of them are working day and night to try and keep up with the needs of the Zionist military. So that's just an overview of what Elbit is doing.
And a really good one. I just want to add one quick quote to that. How the Iran suffered a defeat, Israel was successful militarily, and that they were the manufacturers of the weapons have congratulated the IDF for a perfect execution. So they are cock-a-hoop with the success of many of their weapons over the last few days. Sorry, Helena, go ahead. I know I interrupted.
No. I mean, I just wanted to note a couple of things. One is that I think it was in late November or early December, there was an international arms fair, you know, in Singapore. And mm-hmm. Israel went there with Elbit, and they were already then, you know, just a few weeks into the genocide, crowing about how successful their systems were. So, you know, they're obviously going to be counting on an international market long after they have proven these weapons in Gaza. And it's just an outrageous thing. The other is something that actually Yusuf posted on Twitter yesterday about the quadcopters. Tell us, Yusuf. It's just a horrible story.
So Israel has been using these for the first time ever. So they did not use these quad-copter drones in 2014. They use other types of larger drones to target Palestinians, but this time they've been using these quadcopters to emit the voice of crying babies and women asking for help. And once Palestinian civilians go out to the street to help, they shoot and kill them. They kill dozens of people. This way, they did it in Khan Yunis. They did it in Nusayrat. They're doing it in the new camp in Nusayrat now as they are advancing and destroying. And it's very dangerous, very scary, because you never know, these small drones would get into your bedroom, literally, like they would shoot at windows, break through these windows and get into your bedroom and kill you. Some of them are suicidal. Some of them are equipped with ammunition. And again, families do not know what happened to their kids. They just, you know, go missing, and then they find out, if they find out about what happened to them. And they're very small. You cannot see them. You cannot hear them. They're very scary and dangerous. So people stick to their homes, to their bedroom. Maybe some of them stay in the living room where they are able to close, you know, all these windows and doors so that these quad captors wouldn't get into their homes. And again, the Israeli military uses these or this type of drones a lot. They make sure that before they, you know, bomb a building or get into a building, that this building is safe for them. But again, they're using them to kill more people.
Huda, you have had success with this, though, shutting down some of the manufacturers, the plants that are in the UK. So can you just share a little bit about how difficult that was and how it actually has gone for you guys with direct action, actual proper, you know, getting under their skin, direct action?
Yeah, so just recently, I think just over a month ago, it was announced that Tamworth, so one of their Elbit factories that they had in Tamworth, they used to make parts for the tanks, for the Israeli tanks. Like, they would make the cooling units for the Israeli tanks, and they've been heavily targeted by Palestine Action. We had several different people go in groups, and they would go on the roof of this factory and take it apart, basically. And, you know, they would do it month after month after month. And at one point, they had to shut down the site temporarily to rebuild it because they had to rebuild the damage. And they had to put shutters all over the building, put fencing all around it. It became like a prison in some senses of how they tried to build the security around it. And they had to pay a lot for the security. And it came out that they were forced to sell the site because of how much their profits had gone down. They'd gone down by 75%, mostly because of interruptions and because of these increased security costs that they just couldn't maintain a profitable business. And the new owners had written to Palestine Action to explain that they are no longer Elbit and that their new board had unanimously agreed to have nothing to do with the arms trade. So now the factory will only be making cooling units for buses and trains. So that is one less Israeli weapons factory in this country. And so that was great news to hear. It's also validation of our strategy, which is about direct action disruption and making it impossible for them to operate. Similarly, in a town called Oldham in the north of England, there was a weapons factory there. And we had a lot of direct action at that site. And again, you know, they had got so much security around that site. They had people with dogs walking on the roof because we'd always go for the roof. And then people would go inside and it was just relentless. That and the community would always come out against the factory. And they were forced to sell that site, and Elbit had left Oldham. And this was in 2022. And similarly, they had to leave their headquarters in London, where basically none of them are working and using that space anymore. So these are three sites that we have effectively got rid of from Elbit's portfolio. And the reason why this is significant, and it goes back to what we were saying about Elbit, is Elbit's strategy globally and how they use Gaza is they want to expand. In different countries, they will buy new factories across different countries and get them building their technology which has been used in Gaza, so that they can sell it to other regimes. And so when that's going backwards for Elbit in England, which it is now, you know, they've lost a significant number of sites compared to how many they started off with, then they are, you know, it's backfiring on them. And for us, you know, we won't stop until we completely get rid of Elbit in this country. And I think it's important to weaken the allies of Israel, in the sense that Britain is deemed to be a very strong ally of the Zionist regime. But, you know, we know our government isn't going to sanction them. You know, we've seen that throughout these past 6 months. How much more evidence do they need to implement sanctions? But rather than that, we the people can implement our own sanctions and make it impossible for Israel to build these weapons on our doorstep in this country.
Huda, I have so many questions. Can I just throw some in and I just want to hear your answers. One is, you talked about the community in Oldham standing with you guys. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about the intersectionality. Did you have like support from the trade union movement, other kind of local movements? That's one. And another is, I know there's Elbit factories here in the United States. Are you in touch with activists here? And the last one is about the kind of the police and court system coming down against you guys and just like, tell me everything.
So in terms of the local support, so we have a lot of local support across different communities where these factories are. You know, we've in Leicester, Oldham was a great example. Many, many different places, the community tend to come out in support of these actions against these factories. And in Oldham, it was a range of people. I would say on the trade union front, there may be like local branches that support us, but generally the big trade unions. And actually, it was really disappointing to see that one of the heads of the major trade union in this country came out and said that basically, to summarize, that the jobs in the defense market came above stopping them sending weapons to Israel. And so for us, we bypass that system and we go straight for it. And also in terms of actual workers at Elbit, a lot of their senior staff come from Israel and they, you know, the senior managers are Israelis themselves. And they have highly, you know, these are highly kind of specialized jobs. That they have. What was the second question? Sorry, I couldn't.
Oh, about here in the United States, Elbit.
Yeah. So we recently launched Palestine Action US, and that was just after October 7th. They began taking action against Elbit there. So they did actions against Elbit in Cambridge. I think that's near Boston, but don't quote me on that. And they did actions in Merrimack, I think is the one. So it has, and in different places like Pennsylvania, they've been doing actions. So it's really picking up. But also, not just the US, we've had people now in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Germany are starting, and Italy and other places across Europe are now using similar. You know, starting Palestine Action there, their own groups there to take direct action against these weapons manufacturers. So it's really, you know, making it very difficult for Elbit Systems and these companies to continue to be complicit. And ultimately, that's what, you know, it is at the end of the day. We have to make it more difficult for them to continue to operate than it is for them to and eventually force them out that way by upping the pressure as much as possible. And they are businesses at the end of the day. So if they can't operate, if they can't get contracts, if they can't open up on days, you know, if they don't know from one day to the next if they're going to open up, it makes it very difficult for them to continue. To continue these businesses. So it's exciting to see it grow.
And the police reaction, though, because I can tell you, we always have this idea that, you know, in Ireland we have the Gardaí, and the Gardaí crackdown on in the interest of capital, shall we say, and this would fit under that very much in the interest of weapons capital. So how has the police in reaction been?
Yeah, I mean, the police do not like us, as you can imagine. And, you know, they are agents for the state. And we can also, there's also a massive overlap between Elbit and the police. So, you know, it's completely biased. There's no pretending that the police care about balancing our rights versus the rights of Elbit Systems. A lot of the people who work as their senior security, the chief of security for Elbit, many of them would have been police officers first. So some of them worked for the police for 27 years. You know, these are retired senior police officers that work to protect Elbit. So for them, all they have to do is call up their friends in the police. And, you know, we've seen a lot of dodgy things come from that. And, you know, a lot of strong reactions, raids of people, you know, many arrests, things like that, court cases, and different tactics that they will use to intimidate us. But, you know, the key thing is when you're engaging in this type of activism is understanding that they will do everything possible to stop you. And every time you continue and overcome those obstacles, you get closer to your goal. And that, you know, we pull everything in context of what Palestinians are going through and what these weapons do to the Palestinian people. And the consequences we can have, you know, cannot compare to the consequences of having these weapons continue.
But I think you've had a couple of victories in the court system when you're able to present your case to the jury and people say what you're doing is justified. Is that right?
Yeah, so we've had lots of different court cases. We've won some we haven't. It is hit and miss. You know, one of the things for us is about, you know, being able to say in a courtroom in front of a jury why we're taking these actions. And, you know, and that's very powerful in and of itself. And also for us, the vast majority of people in Palestine Action will say we're not guilty. So you have a choice between when you're being charged with something to say you're guilty or not. And when you're guilty, you can get a reduced sentence. But if you go not guilty, you get a trial. And the reason that we say not guilty is out of principle that the people stopping these weapons companies are not criminal, that the companies themselves are the criminal ones, and that we are having to do this because our country is so complicit in these crimes against the Palestinians. The issue we have is that the courts have changed the law a lot since we started. So we used to be able to, you know, and sometimes we still can. It's potluck on the judge you get, which court you're in, those kind of things. And we used to be able to, or some people would want, what we would want to argue is that we are acting to prevent the greater crime. These are defenses in English law, that we are acting to save lives. Again, another defense in English law. What we're doing is proportionate to what Elbit is doing. And these types of arguments, which actually turn it around onto Elbit, the company, and why we have to take these actions in the first place. Now they're making it more difficult for people and saying you can't rely on these defenses. It still doesn't mean you can't make your case. And it still doesn't mean that a jury can still acquit you either way. So for us, the court system is part of our fight. It's part of the action. You do the action, it's not over. Then you plead your case and stay strong throughout it. Because, you know, they do try and they have tried to give people deals and, you know, they try to give me a deal and things like that. And you just have to, you know, we won't collaborate with them and we're going to keep going on making our points regardless.
I just got an update from my sister that they're shooting randomly at people. There are two people near her house who were injured. Other people were killed. They're destroying high rises so far, four of them in the new camp, in Nusayrat refugee camp. And, you know, there has been a case at the ICJ against Israel of committing a genocide that was brought up by South Africa. How do you see this case playing into pressuring more countries, seeing how, for example, I think it was Belgium deciding not to sell F-35 parts to Israel, other countries deciding not to send quote-unquote offensive weapons to Israel? How do you see that playing into somehow isolating Elbit systems as well?
Yeah, I think with the ICJ result, it's a tool that people can use. It's not the end all and be all, but it's definitely a tool. And, you know, like, for example, in England, they have laws which say that you cannot export arms to a country if there is a risk it's going to be used to violate international law. Now, there's no doubt with the ICJ ruling that that they shouldn't be sending arms. There should be an arms embargo. It's as clear as day. But still, they're still continuing to do these things. So I think later down the line, there's going to be a lot of things that people have to answer for and accountability. And as we can see, they are openly committing crimes by continuing to do this. But I think in general, people can use it as a tool to isolate companies like Elbit. You know, we saw in Japan, for example, that they cut contracts with Elbit. And, you know, one of the reasons, there had been a solid campaign, but the ICJ ruling, I think, was a tip of the iceberg for the people they were pressuring in terms of saying, well, here it is, here's the evidence, it's a crime. And, you know, we shouldn't need these things to validate it. But you know, having that ruling does help. But, you know, on the other hand, as in order to isolate Israel and isolate companies like Elbit, but on the other hand, it's not the ICJ ruling in and of itself isn't strong enough to stop the genocide.
Just to make quick, there's also in the US, obviously, the Leahy laws should allow for that as well. But the EU has similar laws under human rights that actually Ireland and Spain have said, we want the EU to look into whether there's been breaches. Again, Ireland, yay, we're doing great. We're not doing enough. Like, we shouldn't be calling for us to look into it. We should just be saying these are clear breaches. But nonetheless, that's where it is in terms of the EU and the US position. It's very clear that both have these laws, but they're being breached by Israel, so they don't really care too much. The last thing I want to say though is just, and it is again, I put this for our Irish listeners, Shannon Airport. Is a base where it's people fly domestically out of Shannon Airport. But today, while we're recording, there's been four flights, military flights through Shannon Airport. One which is destined for Tel Aviv, and that's in the last few hours. So, you know, hundreds of people showed up last Sunday to protest about Shannon and how it's part of the war machine. And considering Ireland is supposed to be a neutral country, that's a clear breach of that. So just if you're listening to this, you can get involved. Just Google Shannon Watch and you can help there as well. So that's a way of taking direct action there. And I know several of the activists who've done that as well. So that's my two cents out of the way.
Thank you, Tony. I think as we speak, we're steadily and unfortunately heading towards regional war. We've seen how, you know, the Israeli Air Force targeted a building belonging to the Iranian embassy in Damascus almost 2 weeks ago, and how Iran has responded by firing missiles and drones into Israel 3 days ago. And now Israel is threatening to target Iran and assassinate Iranian officials. And Iran said, if this happens, we will retaliate immediately. Helena, how do you see the scene from Washington, D.C.?
I think I see there's an interesting shift in the global balance. You know, back in 1999, I think it was 99, when the U.S. Air Force actually hit the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, and it was able to get away with that gross violation of international law because it was still the 1990s. The U.S. was hegemonic worldwide, and Israel being, you know, kind of the junior partner in a lot of this imperial venture has been doing the same with impunity against targets in Lebanon and Syria and occasionally Iran for many years. But what happened on April 1st was unprecedented in that the Iranians retaliated and they signaled in advance that they were going to do so. They used intermediaries because, like, the head of the CIA, Bill Burns, went to Oman, and Oman is well known as a kind of an intermediary place where either, you know, sitting in rooms next to each other or maybe sitting in a room together, the Iranians and Americans can communicate. And in one way or another, the Iranians communicated that they were going to, this time after the April 1st killing, they were going to retaliate, and the retaliation would be against Israel directly and would be limited in nature. And so for the next 10, 12 days, people in Israel were really terrified. They didn't know what was coming. But, you know, the military was meantime coordinating extremely closely with the militaries of the U.S., which had destroyers in the Eastern Mediterranean, and Jordan, And the US also has the bases in eastern Syria and in Iraq and in Bahrain, crucially, and Qatar, crucially. So, you know, there's a lot of US footprint there. And the Israelis, the Americans, the Jordanians, the Brits, and to some extent the French, set up this massive kind of missile defense system with five different layers. And the Iranians launched this very, very smart operation that had hundreds of drones, very slow drones, just going very close to the ground, all across from Iran. That's about 1,000 miles or whatever, maybe less, to Israel. And then they got shot down, mainly over Jordan, by the Americans and perhaps by the Israeli Air Force also operating over Jordan. But by doing that, the Iranians were able to see the nature of the Western response. And then they pushed their cruise missiles and a couple of ballistic missiles through. And maybe 7 or 8 of these missiles landed in Israel on military targets. You know, it was really a smart Iranian operation. It was targeted against the 2 air bases in Israel that had been responsible both for the attack against the Iranian consulate in Damascus and majorly involved in the Israeli Air Force actions in Gaza. So, you know, they injured 1 Palestinian Israeli girl who was near one of these air bases, but they didn't kill, you know, large numbers of, or any, they didn't kill anybody from the Israeli public that was cowering in their shelters, terrified as to what would happen. So now we have a different situation, you know, that the US and its allies can no longer assassinate, take out, blow up things that belong to their perceived opponents like Iran or Hezbollah with, you know, with complete impunity. And that is a huge shift. So we're going to have to see, you know, what effect that has on for the people of Gaza. I hope that it leads the Israelis to say that, you know, they need to have a ceasefire in Gaza ASAP, because this thing could all get radically out of control.
Thank you very much, Helena, for this regional update. I think it's important and it's developing. So we will see what Israel is going to do and how Iran is going to retaliate and respond. And Hoda, thank you very much for your contribution. In fact, the fact that Elbit system is using Gaza as a testing lab reminds me of Israel's use of prisons and Palestinian political prisoners as a testing lab for their medicines. And there is a Palestinian professor at, I forgot her name now, at the Hebrew University. She was actually fired recently after October 7. She was attacked harshly when she revealed, you know, these Israeli testing plans on Palestinian political prisoners. And the same way, this is how they view Gaza. For them, Gaza is a testing lab.
And a prison.
Testing on Palestinians there. I remember there was an article in Haaretz in 2014 that read Israeli weapons after being tested on Palestinians in Gaza in 2014 are selling like hot cake. Literally, this is what they said. Unfortunately, and I think they are going to promote and, you know, brag about many other weapons soon after the genocide ends in Gaza. Thank you very much for your work and your contribution and being with us today. I think it's important that the work you do and the information you provided about Elbit systems and their role in the genocide. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I wish the best for you and your family too.
Thank you. And a great scarf, Tony, you have in there. It says Free Palestine. I think it combines Ireland and then Palestine.
It's on Palestine.
So it's it was one of the, I think I've told you this before, we were trying to get the Arabic correct, so it was Rifat and Loe Elbasani who helped do the, but they're designed by the Irish artist, Spice Bag is Adam Doyle, and we're using them to raise funds for, unfortunately, people who need money for GoFundMes to get their families out of Gaza. But here we are, so I just wanted to plug that at the end, but it is what it is. And thank you to Adam for allowing us to do it without, he's actually not taking anything from it, so it says a lot about real activist art and activist and the art and how it can combine. Thank you, Huda, thank you, Yusuf, and thank you, Helena,
and thank you to our co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya. Talk to you next week.
Crimes against humanity, leaders looked away from a live stream genocide. Trucks are filled with food supplies, kept outside, telling us that black is white, but the world is seeing right through Israeli lies. Using the weapon of hunger, life is a game to these monsters who would starve a child. Every day they're losing their lives. Death raining down from a mysterious sky, fleeing from their homes, waiting to die by the gun of an evil, twisted Zionist mind. But with all the guns and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. Palestine. Mocking victims for the world to see, sickening scenes on TikTok streams, the moral rot and the souls of the IDF. Using the weapon of hunger, life is a game to these monsters who would starve a child. Every day they're losing their lives. Death raining down from a mysterious sky, fleeing from their homes, waiting to die by the gun of an evil, twisted Zionist mind. But with all the guns and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. But with all the tanks and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. Palestine.